Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In December of 2021, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued an advisory to raise the alarm on a growing mental health crisis. He wrote, "Mental health challenges in children, adolescents, and young adults are real and widespread. Even before the pandemic, an alarming number of young people struggled with feelings of helplessness, depression, and thoughts of suicide, and rates have increased over the past decade. The COVID-19 pandemic further altered their experiences at home, school, and in the community, and the effect on their mental health has been devastating." Later in the hour, we'll focus on how we can identify young people who are struggling and help them. But first, I've asked one family to share their story. Michael and Rebecca have four children, and over the past year, one of their sons has struggled with serious depression. A few months ago, he tried to take his own life. He's doing better now, and Michael and Rebecca want to share their story to raise awareness about how difficult it is to get mental health care for young people in Iowa and to break the silence that surrounds so many of these struggles. We're using only their first names to protect the family's privacy. And Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thank you both so much for being willing to share this story. I know it's a really difficult one to talk about. Now, I want to go back in time because your son really started struggling with depression in December of 2020. Rebecca, can you kind of just talk me through the timeline of what you saw and how things have progressed?
Right. So, you know, he actually started experiencing depressive symptoms during online school, during that first stage of COVID. And we got him hooked up with a therapist who was doing great work with him. And honestly, we thought, okay, once you go back to school, like once you get back into school, like everything's going to go away and be fine. And that was kind of the opposite of what happened. It actually sort of accelerated his anxiety, his depression. And then by October, he was self-harming. We had a great relationship with his therapist who alerted us to this, and we were very quickly able to get him in with a psychologist or a psychiatrist and worked with his really wonderful primary care physician to make some medication adjustments. And honestly, I thought, hey, we're doing a really great job as parents, right? Like, this is not the experience we would have had when we were growing up. And then those are the thoughts I had about a week before he made an attempt on his life.
Wow. After he made an attempt on his life, he was hospitalized. And even a few weeks after that hospitalization, you felt like he was in danger again and he needed to go back to the hospital.
He did, yes. This time around, we were way more alert to how he was doing and were able to make it such that he didn't do a full attempt again. But it became quite clear, despite we pulled in every resource we had for mental health in the area to try to keep him out of the hospital a second time. And finally got to the point where we realized it's not going to happen. And so when he went back to the hospital, it was for a good solid 2 weeks. It was, we've been really fortunate. All of our children are very healthy. And so we had never experienced anything like that as parents to have one of our kids hospitalized for such a long period of time. But they were able to do a lot more therapy with him and really set him up well to come out more healthy than he did the first time.
And we'll talk about some of the resources that you were able to take advantage of. Michael, I think it's so important for all of us to understand that this kind of thing can happen in any family. I mean, your son is 14 years old, which is a tumultuous time of life
Yes.
for a lot of people. But this is not something that you ever would have suspected or expected.
He's had a fairly ordinary childhood. There were no particular warning signs that would make us think that other than the things that we were describing and having ordinary adolescent junior high concerns. So it was... it is not something that we expected. And I personally struggled with depression at various points, but it was much later in life when I did. And so there were no traumatic events that spurred it to happen initially, other than, you know, the traumatic
event. Worldwide traumatic event,
yes.
which does seem to be something that has triggered a lot of young people, just that upheaval. But also, I mean, I think other elements of it as well. And we've all struggled in the last 2 years. But when you recognized that he was experiencing depression and sought help, what were you able to find for him?
Yeah, I remember that really clearly because there was one day in December of 2020 where it was like the third or fourth day of him breaking down in tears. And I had this moment where I'm like, what he is experiencing is beyond what I can provide him as a parent. And this is the time to bring in additional supports. And so, we are fairly have a good working knowledge of the mental health resources in our community. And I immediately called a very reputable counseling service and said, hey, my son needs to be set up as a patient. And they said, okay, our waiting list is 6 months. And I thought, oh boy. Oh,
wow.
And so I said, well, put him on the list and we'll just hobble along as best we can until that time comes. And so we were fortunate that we only had to wait 3 months to get him in. And he wasn't in such a crisis mode at that point that, that worked out okay for us at the time. But it definitely underscored to me the vast need that was taking place and how inadequate the resources were to meet it.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that he was experiencing depression, that there were tears and that kind of frustration. When he went back to school, what kinds of things was he experiencing?
He had a lot of social anxiety that you would ordinarily have, I think, in junior high. But I think that he had developed certain an inability to cope with those difficult adolescent experiences that we all had. And it would go very quickly from some sideways comment here or there, either from a teacher or a fellow classmate, or even from me in a lot of cases, to that person doesn't like me, they hate me, my life isn't worth living. And it was very quick that he hadn't developed the off-ramps from escalating from 0 to 60 so quickly. And I think that was probably the biggest struggle for him, is that transition had happened so much, so often during because of his depression, that then you'd get lots of sideways comments and it would turn into very quickly those kinds of negative self-talk and life isn't worth living kind of thoughts.
That's an experience that a lot of young people go through, and it's so hard for their parents to watch them hurting themselves. I can also imagine that there must have been was it even hard to believe that it was real?
Well, it was, unfortunately, we could see it, so we knew it was real. I think that my struggle was that, of course, when you see your child harming themselves, your first thought is stop doing that immediately, because, you know, you have such a massive amount of love for them and just, you know, you've spent your whole life as a parent protecting them. And then to watch them hurt themselves is just mind-boggling, right? And so, but there was a bit of denial, I think, to some degree. Like, I could never bring myself to think like, oh, you are going to harm yourself to the point of death, right? Like, I was just like, you come from a loving home. You have parents that love and accept you. And I was very careful in the self-harming phase to never shame him for that either. It was always like, I really would love you to not do that. I know that you're hurting right now, but I'm not going to fuss at you. I'm not going to shame you for these actions. And I want to help you and let's work through this. But, you know, I definitely, even after he made the attempt on his life, I still was like, oh, the way he did it was in such a way that would not have ended his life. And even in that, I just had such magical thinking about it. I was like, this wasn't real. It's a cry for help. It's, he wasn't really trying to end his life. And it wasn't until a friend came along and said, you know, Rebecca, he didn't know that doing what he did wouldn't end his life, that I realized that, oh my goodness, this is extremely serious. And I just was in denial about that for a period of time.
When he did make that attempt on his life and needed to be hospitalized, you couldn't get care in your town.
Right, right.
So what did you have to do?
He was sent to a child psych facility about an hour from our house. We, you know, and it's one of those things too with COVID protocols, the visitation was a little bit wonky. And so, you know, it's like I have a friend right now whose child has leukemia and so and is in the hospital. And of course, that experience is vastly different than the experience of a child who's experiencing mental health struggles. Like there's no, you don't take pictures of them in the child psych facility surrounded by balloons and flowers and nobody writes them letters. Like it's just, it's a vastly different experience. And part of that was on me. Like I felt very protective of this story. And I think in the moment I wanted to control it a little bit because so much was out of control. And my way of controlling it was to tell the fewest people possible about what we were experiencing, which was ultimately harmful to our family because we are surrounded by a, you know, an incredibly loving, wonderful community of people, you know, from our church to our school, everywhere, that I didn't even give the opportunity to offer us support.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Michael and Rebecca about their son's mental health crisis and what they have gone through in the past couple of years. Many young people are struggling with mental health right now, and we will talk more about that as the hour goes on. If you know someone in your life who is struggling, or if you yourself are struggling, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. And just this month, Iowa launched a new information campaign focused on mental health and suicide prevention for young people. You can find more information at yourlifeiowa.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com. Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about the mental health crisis for young people in this country right now. And in a few minutes, we'll be focusing on how to recognize when a young person in your life needs help and how to help them. Right now, we're focusing on a personal story. Michael and Rebecca are the parents of four children, and over the past year, one of their sons has struggled with serious depression. A few months ago, he tried to take his own life. He has been hospitalized twice, and they are sharing what they have gone through. And before the break, Rebecca, you were talking about how very, very different it is to have a child going through this kind of crisis than going through another kind of crisis. And the reason that I learned about what you went through is because you decided to break that silence and share your story on Facebook so that other people who are going through it can also know they're not alone, but also to give your community, the people who love you, an opportunity to offer support to you. Talk to me a little bit about your thoughts about the stigma and the shame that kept you silent.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I didn't quite realize how deeply the stigma had impacted me because I thought I had grown into a person who, you know, would acknowledge things like you know, depression and anxiety and talk about the importance of, you know, communicating about mental health struggles. But then it's a different scenario when you're a parent, I think, too, because it's not the thing that's happening to you. It's the thing that's happening to your child. And I think for better or for worse, you know, we have a friend who talks about how as parents, we take too much credit and too much blame for the actions of our children. And at the time, I was putting a lot of blame on myself, right? Like, why didn't I see this coming? Why didn't I equip him better? How could I not have protected him better? And and also, how could a well-loved child ever want to end their life, right? And so, and then I did have this friend who reached out to me, who was one of the few people that knew about this and said, hey, I have a friend who lives in another state whose child is going through the exact same thing. And I remember in that moment, I took so much comfort from knowing that, like, oh no, this is a very common experience right now, right? Like, this isn't, there are so many children, like, across
literally
the board.
Millions of children in the United States and probably all over the world are going through this right now.
Exactly. And so, and I think that helped. It helped sort of, I don't know, it helped me shame myself less a little bit, as well as just also recognizing that, helped me unpack the reason why I was unwilling to sort of talk about it with my community and how that ultimately it was a piece of stigma that was keeping me from doing that.
Another reason that you decided to share this story was also just to share what you had learned from this experience. I mean, you both are very well educated and in so many ways really well equipped to deal with this kind of a problem, and yet your learning curve was also steep here. So I want to give both of you the opportunity just to say, you know, okay, if I had this to do over again, this is where I would look for her help. This is what I would do. And Michael, do you want to start?
Yeah, probably the first thing is we didn't really reach out to the school counselor until after he had been hospitalized the first time. And the school was extremely supportive and helpful and was willing to work with and coordinate with other mental health care providers to implement coping skills and things like that to deal with stressors that were in school, changing schedules that can't be changed, and things like that to make it work out well. And the counselor was just an enormous help for our son and for us as parents. And so that was one thing.
And I think once we get up into secondary school, a lot of us think that counselors mostly work on our kids' schedules, but it sounds like they were really well equipped to help with this.
Yes, and we're even suggesting types of mental health care that she thought would be useful for him, which turned out to, in a second hospitalization, to be what helped him out.
That's great.
So that was helpful as well. Another thing I think is, I think recognizing, and I would say this is still something that I'm dealing with now, is recognizing that it's not something that goes away immediately after dealing with the crisis. I still have times where I worry every time I get a call from the school or notification of a missed class because he was in the bathroom at school.
Yeah.
So I don't expect that something bad is going to happen, but I still worry about it, and that's hard to deal with. So dealing with the trauma for both him and for us is a long haul.
Yeah, and for the rest of our kids too. I think that's been, you know, as a family thing that we've gone through, and just trying to make sure that everybody's well taken care of, that, you know, we're well taken care of, our son is well taken care of, our other children are well taken care of. And so, and I think that's the benefit then of when we reached out to our community more, that allowed us to have even added supports there. So, and I definitely would echo what Michael said about the resources that we experienced through Iowa Public Schools were absolutely phenomenal. And I really wish that we had reached out for them sooner, because they were such a fantastic partner in our son's journey. And we've been just deeply grateful for that.
You reached out for help right away. And as you mentioned earlier, there was a long waiting list. Although you didn't wait 6 months, you still waited 3 or 4 months before your son could actually see a counselor and start that process of treatment. When you had to, in a crisis moment, have him hospitalized, he had to go an hour away. And there is a lack of beds for young people who are in crisis. This is something that we hear about on the news. It's something we report about. But you've seen this firsthand. I mean, that's really scary to think that there's not a bed for your child who could have died.
Right. No, for sure. And I just think that the phrase, like, we need more mental health supports, just does not in any way encompass the dire need of so many families and kids and adults and in our communities right now. And, you know, I think that it's wonderful that as a society we have a much better handle on why mental health is important and understanding why that's such a vital thing to work through in our lives. But then if you don't have the personnel there, then that's really scary and frightening.
Yeah. Yeah, to add to that, too, the second hospitalization was about a month, not even quite a month, after the first one. And the reason, I think, why that happened was because the first hospitalization was just to get him out of, I'm going to actively try to take my life, that stage, and not deal with any of the underlying mental health issues there. So much so that they arose very quickly after getting out of that immediate crisis situation. And so it wasn't until he was able to get a spot in a psychiatric unit, an adolescent psychiatric unit, and for a longer period of time that he was able to start dealing with that in a way that was healthy and positive.
Right. And really so, got the therapy and the care that he needed. So as we leave this conversation, I just want to say thank you to both of you for being so vulnerable and sharing this story. Also, I realize that this is a forever problem. This is something that you'll always be concerned about, and it may crop up again. Rebecca, what are your thoughts about that? This is part of this son that you love so much.
Yeah, we have a friend who is just very wise. And I remember one time she told me, you know, what you're doing right now is you're giving him a toolbox, right? And you're giving him all the skills he's going to need so that when he becomes an adult, right, like he's, you know, likely to experience this again at some point. And you will have equipped him with the tools that he needs. And also just you've broken some stigma there too, where he's like, okay, I'm sad, I'm anxious, I'm depressed, I know exactly what to do, I know who to call, this is normal. And so that's how I'm soothing myself right now, because yes, it is stressful, it is scary. And yes, that's how I'm handling that.
Yeah, I would agree with that too, that, you know, I didn't really start dealing with my own depression until I was an adult. And I think I am hopeful that he'll have the resources and ability to do that. One of the challenges I think that we've seen is that now that he is not currently in a crisis mode, is that he can think that things are better now and things are fixed now. And so there's less motivation for him to actively want medication or therapy or other types of support, because it's things are fine now, Dad. So
yeah,
and that's hard to develop in times of not having a crisis, the resources that he'll need if he does have another crisis.
And I know adults who've gone through that exact same cycle as well. That is a real challenge. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Rebecca and Michael, and of course, that's one family story. There are so many families going through similar struggles right now. And if you or someone in your life is struggling, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. And just this month, Iowa launched a new information campaign focused on mental health and suicide prevention for young people. You can find more information at yourlifeiowa.org. And my next guests are hosting a webinar this afternoon at 5:30. It's called Youth Suicide Prevention and Question, Persuade, Refer. It's a free webinar for K through 12 education professionals sponsored by Iowa Center for School Mental Health and University of Iowa Baker Teacher Leader Center. With me, Laura Gallo, Assistant Professor of School Counseling at the University of Iowa College of Education and Affiliate Research Faculty at the Iowa Center for School Mental Health. Laura, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
And Jacob Priest is also here, Associate Professor of Psychological and Quantitative Foundations at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. Hello, Jacob.
Hi, great to be here.
Thank you both for being here. And of course, we are talking about suicide. This is a very difficult subject to talk about. It's also something that I think a lot of us are afraid to talk about because there's this idea that even mentioning suicide could trigger a crisis for someone. But it's also so important to talk about. Laura, why don't you start us off? I mean, starting these conversations and then having these conversations with parents, but also with educators is so important and so vital. Tell me a little bit about how you think about talking about suicide prevention.
Yeah, you're right. It is a very important topic and a conversation that we need to start engaging in and welcoming folks to have with each other so that our youth are more willing to come and talk to us as well. I think we have a lot of issues within our society around shame and stigma that keep us from embracing that conversation, which of course then keeps our youth from being willing to come and talk to us about that. So when I talk with educators in particular, we generally start off with talking about what our own feelings are around the topic of suicide, whether, you know, what biases they might have, what assumptions they make, because we often bring those into the conversation and without meaning to. So unintentionally bringing those in, which then hold some judgment. And so if we have somebody who's vulnerable, who has some suicidal ideation, that could deter them from talking to us about it. And that's not what we want to do. We want them to feel open and welcome to begin that conversation so we can help them get support and help.
Well, and as I said, I mean, there is this idea that even saying the word suicide mm-hmm. could give someone that idea. And that prevents a lot of professionals from even asking the question of a young person. What do we need to know about that?
Absolutely. That's a pretty common myth that's out there. And in fact, when I've done trainings with educators, literally some of them have actually whispered the word suicide because they're so afraid of the topic and don't understand that until we understand that suicide isn't that talking about suicide with young people isn't going to put it the idea in their head that what we're doing is really just like once again opening that conversation. So that's a pretty big myth that needs to be dispelled, that we could possibly plant the idea in their head by bringing it up when that's not the case at all. If somebody's had a suicidal thought, it's already there. It's just our job to help them process that and open that conversation.
And even naming that mm-hmm. could give them power.
Absolutely. In fact, the actual act of asking somebody if they've had thoughts of suicide and that person being able to provide that conversation, have that response of, well, wow, yeah, I have had that thought can be an intervention in itself, that conversation. So absolutely.
And before we start talking about some of the interventions that are possible, some of the warning signs and some of the roles that education professionals can play, I do think it's important. And Jacob, maybe you can reinforce this for me. We're talking about suicide prevention. Suicide prevention is not always successful, and people carry a lot of fear and a lot of guilt about that. So when we're talking about suicide prevention, there is no surefire method. People can do all the right things and still experience this crisis.
Yeah, I think the example of the couple you just spoke to really demonstrates that. They were trying to get their son help. They were connecting with him, with people in his community, and still he had an attempt on his life. And so when, you know, to take this notion that, you know, like, oh, there's a surefire way to prevent this, unfortunately, there's not. But what we hope to do is create the structures and supports and systems and processes that allow those who are struggling to have multiple avenues to give help. Because when you have that, that's when you are going to be able to catch the person who might be falling through the cracks. But you're right. There isn't one way that you're going to be able to, like, okay, if you do this, then you're going to prevent that. And that's really hard, and that's really difficult to struggle if you've had a loved one who's attempted to take their life or has died by suicide. It can be really difficult.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jacob Priest, Associate Professor of Psychological and Quantitative Foundations at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. Laura Gallo is also here, Assistant Professor of School Counseling at the University of Iowa College of Education. And they are going to be presenting a webinar, a free webinar for educators this afternoon at 5:30. It's called Youth Suicide Prevention and Question, Persuade, Refer. That again is a free webinar for K-12 education professionals. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. I also want to mention once again that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is always available at 800-273-8255. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we are talking about the mental health crisis that our young people are going through right now. We are also talking about suicide prevention. And again, if you or someone in your life is struggling, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. My guests right now are Laura Gallo and Jacob Priest from the University of Iowa, and they're presenting a webinar this afternoon at 5:30 called Youth Suicide Prevention and Question, Persuade, Refer. It's a free webinar for K-12 education professionals sponsored by Iowa Center for School Mental Health and the University of Iowa Baker Teacher Leader Center. And let's talk a little bit about the role of educators in helping young people who may be in crisis. And I'll start with you, Laura. We're not saying that teachers should be therapists, but of course, teachers are in contact with students all the time. So they may be the person who sees some warning signs. Tell me what we're beginning to see as the role of teachers in suicide prevention.
Exactly. Teachers are working with students on a daily basis. They get to interact with them. They often hear their stories, see their writings, where a lot of these sensitive topics can come up, and certainly thoughts of suicide might appear. And I think teachers are realizing, wow, these are pretty big feelings. These are big issues that these students are having. And we do know that young people can have thoughts of suicide, can attempt suicide. So we all need to take it very seriously. Every thought or comment, every piece of writing, it's not something we can just dismiss as like, oh, they're just trying to get attention, or, oh, they're, they're just having a bad day. We realize that all of these are worth further exploration. So teachers are a huge part of the prevention kind of pipeline as far as helping approach the student, being very open and comfortable as we can be, right, having these conversations. And that's why trainings are really important to help facilitate that. So they are able to provide this kind of welcoming attitude towards students to come in and to talk about that, have those conversations. And then they are able to do a warm handoff to that school counselor or to...
And what does that mean?
So a warm handoff would be the student comes in, is able to identify some, suicidal thoughts, feelings they have. The teacher, it depends on, you know, how comfortable the teacher is allowing them to tell their story. But at some point, what they want to do is walk the student down to the school counselor or school social worker, whoever's available to then do a more thorough risk assessment.
Right, because you don't want to leave that child alone.
Correct.
Yep. And we heard earlier with Rebecca and Michael sharing their story, they said they wish that they had gone to the school earlier. And Jacob, just share some thoughts about that, because I think especially with secondary education, a lot of us don't fully understand the resources available to junior high and high school or middle school and high school students, because those resources weren't available when we were students. So tell me a little bit about what is available to students now.
Yeah. So, well, first off, to kind of jump on what Laura was saying here, too, I think sometimes when we're presenting to teachers, I feel bad because we've asked teachers, especially in the last few years, to do so much. And now we're asking, oh, now take on this additional responsibility. Yeah. But it's one that's really important. And as Laura talked about, I think a lot of us, when we think back to our experience maybe in junior high and high school, we had guidance counselors. And those guidance counselors were there to say, OK, well, this is the classes you should take. If you got in trouble, maybe you saw them. But today we have trained and licensed school counselors who are trained mental health professionals who are embedded in schools. And they have, you know, this ability to assess, provide intervention for risk factors associated with suicide. And I think that that's maybe an underutilized resource, because if you have in your mind, I'm going to go see the guidance counselor, well, I don't really want to tell them about how I'm feeling. But if you understand that these school counselors, these school social workers have the training and have the ability to not only connect you to resources, but to provide some school-based interventions as well, I think it can be another pathway of getting kids help.
Yeah. And I want to ask you a little bit about the name of the webinar, Question, Persuade, Refer. That refers to a technique that you'll be teaching people. Laura, do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So QPR is actually an evidence-based suicide prevention gatekeeper training program. And so it's one that has been researched and found to be helpful. And a gatekeeper training is really one that aims to educate everybody in, yeah, looking for warning signs, risk factors, and being able to just start that conversation. So feeling a little more comfortable with that student approaching them, or even reaching out to the student, right? Not even waiting for the student to come to them, but reaching out to the student who might be in distress.
All right. And having a framework, having a program that you can run that will help, hopefully, a teacher or other professional respond in a crisis.
Absolutely.
You mentioned warning signs, and I want to talk about that, because I know that's all of us who love young people, that's what we want to know about. Mm-hmm. What are the warning signs that we should be looking for?
So there are, if you Google warning signs for suicide, you're going to see lists of many, many, many things. Which I think can be overwhelming. So I have attended quite a few trainings and learned from Dr. David Rudd, who's a clinical psychologist, suicidologist, and he's come up with five warning signs that I think, for me, make the most sense and are easy to remember. So those are the five that I tend to provide for teachers and educators and parents. The first one being agitation. The second being anxiety. That's generally not recognized yet. So maybe they haven't been diagnosed with anxiety, but there's some anxiety that the child is talking about. So there's an indication that they have some anxiety, but once again, it's not been formally diagnosed. So we have agitation, anxiety, hopelessness, perceived burdensomeness. So that one is really important because it's a perception. So it's not just that they truly are a burden. It's just that their perception is that they're a burden on others.
So if they're apologizing to you a lot or talking about how they feel like they are in the way or that you might be better off without them, that kind of thing, that's...
Yep, exactly. So those kind of statements would be certainly red flags. And then the last one, which is a really big one and a little bit more new, is sleep issues, which we see with adolescents a lot. for many reasons, right? We know that with their brain development and things, they tend to want to stay up later, sleep in later, but that's not really how school works. So sleep issues can be pretty big. And then we also have screen time, video gaming, things that keep them up maybe later into the night, maybe even when parents aren't aware. So a lot of sleep issues can certainly factor into their increased state.
So you talked about how important it can be to start this conversation with a child that you see struggling. Mm-hmm. How do you start the conversation to find out if they are having suicidal ideas?
Sure. I think you just are very non-judgmental, asking them how they're doing, and then maybe not accepting the whole "I'm fine," right? So maybe digging a little bit deeper, but trying to do it in a way that doesn't have judgment. And if they do start talking about issues that they're having, problems that they're having, not trying to solve the problem for them, but just allowing them to really talk through that, not giving advice, but just trying to really be open and supportive, offering help. I think that's an important way to start that conversation and allow them to really express what they're feeling, and knowing that you're a safe person to talk to, whether you're a parent or a educator, you know, whoever you are that the child is talking to. I think that's an important, like, your attitude about the conversation is going to be really important.
And I want to reiterate something that we said just a few minutes ago, that it's okay to ask if they are thinking about suicide.
Absolutely. And I would ask very directly, because if you sometimes allude to it or kind of beat around the bush a little bit, children can be very literal. And unfortunately, there have been children that have been missed because they, you know, the person asked, like, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Well, that can mean something very different to a child, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily to them mean that you're asking about suicide. So being very direct.
And of course, this, the rise that we're seeing in suicide among young people is part of this bigger picture, the mental health crisis that we are seeing overall. And Jacob, let's talk about that bigger picture and think about terms of prevention, of not just suicide prevention, but really preventing some of these crises that young people find themselves in. What do you think we should be thinking about?
Well, when I like to use the term, and Laura does as well, of upstream thinking, right? So it's kind of like this little parable or metaphor of you're standing by the side of a river and all of a sudden you see a kid floating by and you jump in the river to save that kid, pull him out of the river. And then all of a sudden there's another kid in the river and you jump in, you save that kid. And it becomes this process of, okay, we've got to focus on what's in the river right now. And that makes a lot of sense, right? If you have a kid you know is struggling, you're focusing on that in the moment. But eventually, hopefully somebody asks, who's chucking these kids in the river, right? Because that means that there's things going on upstream that are leading to these kids falling in and putting themselves in danger. So when it comes to educators, schools, communities, families, it's about thinking about what are we doing before? Like, what's going on ahead of time that can hopefully prevent, you know, some of these kids from falling into the river? And if we can think in that way, it makes it so we still need these, hey, there's going to be kids that regardless of what we do upstream are going to be need help downstream. But if we can think about those upstream interventions, if we can think about how we're creating schools, communities, and classrooms that are sensitive and responsive to the needs of students, then we're more likely to be able to get those interventions early.
We have just gone through this incredible upheaval over the past 2 years, and it has affected everyone, but it has affected young people in surprising ways. And I want to return to something that Rebecca and Michael were talking about, how they saw one of their children struggling while they were, you know, in isolation or in quarantine, as we called it at the time, and thought that once things got back to normal, that these problems would go away. I certainly have thought that way. I know a lot of parents have thought that way. We're seeing, you know, so many young people struggling right now. But as things get back to normal, there is that hope that maybe things will just get back to normal.
it doesn't seem to be working that way. So what do we need to be thinking about and doing right now with the realization of, hey, that something has happened and it's not just going to magically disappear?
Yeah, you know, I think with a lot of things, you know, like if we're talking about chronic illnesses, we often think, you know, we don't expect those just to get better, right? And when it comes to things like depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, they're also tend to be chronic, right? And so when those symptoms start, it's not that like, okay, we're going to have a change of scenery or all of a sudden you're going to go back to school and, you know, flip a switch and everything's okay. It's going to take time to work, sometimes manage those symptoms. Sometimes people do experience full recovery, but that's not always the case. And so you have to think about these things, unfortunately, as the people you're interviewing said, like as chronic. These are going to need to develop the tools to manage this as you go across. And so the idea, the hope, you know, we want that hope that, hey, as soon as kids are back in school, as soon as we're able to go to restaurants again, as soon as we're able, everything will be okay. And when it comes to mental health, that's just not how it works.
We know that there is not enough mental health care available. We've talked about that. And we know that schools are taxed to the max right now. There's just so much going on. But with about 2 minutes left, and I don't expect you to solve all of our problems, but obviously having these conversations with the young people in our lives is very important, and being aware of the danger signs. But what do you think as a society, what do our priorities need to be right now, Laura?
For me, definitely reducing shame and stigma around suicide is huge. That's, once again, the domino effect, right? If society is more understanding of mental health and of suicidal ideation, more people are going to talk about it. More people will come forward for help. So for me, that's huge.
All right. What about you, Jacob?
I think in a culture, we value this idea of resilience. And I think resilience can be really important, right? We need to be resilient. But often that removes the responsibility on these systems that are toxic, right? If we're asking people to be resilient to toxic systems, then what we're really doing is we're giving them the tools to kind of just, you know, stay afloat, when in fact we should be looking at the systems, the policies, you know, the structures in our community and say, what can we do to shift those? Now, that's a harder conversation because it involves more people, policies, politics. But I think if we want to take mental health and especially the mental health of children seriously, that's where we need to start.
And we're talking about young people as a group, but I think that it's important to mention before we go, a lot of people worry about teenagers dealing with these problems, but we're talking about younger children as well, right, Laura?
Absolutely. I just did a study a few years ago and had multiple elementary age students who were actively attempting suicide, even at school. So absolutely an issue for five-year-old children and up.
I mentioned your webinar. People still can sign up for that, right?
I believe so.
Right? Okay.
I think so.
It's at 5:30 this afternoon. It is a free webinar for K-12 education professionals. It's called Youth Suicide Prevention and Question, Persuade, Refer. Jacob Priest, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jacob Priest, Associate Professor of Psychological and Quantitative Foundations at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry. And Laura Gallo, thank you so much.
You bet.
Laura Gallo is Assistant Professor of School Counseling at the University of Iowa College of Education and Affiliate Research Faculty at the Iowa Center for School Mental Health. And again, the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. And there is a new website from the state of Iowa focused on mental health and suicide prevention for young people. You can find out more information at yourlifeiowa.org/children's-mental-health. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.